Next up, we have Callie Holmes, my girl Callie. After completing her master's degree in information studies from the University of Texas, Callie spent 3 years in the recorded sound section at the Library of Congress. Since 2012, she has been an oral history and media archivist at the University of Georgia's Richard B. Russell Library for Political Research and Studies.
Thanks. So as Sandy said, I'm at the Russell Library at the University of Georgia, part of their special collections libraries. And just to give you some background on that, the Russell Library was established in 1974, originally to be the repository for the papers of Senator Richard B. Russell, who was a long-serving senator from Georgia. But since then, our scope has expanded a lot. And so now we kind of collect where politics and policy and culture intersect. So today I'm going to talk to you about the process we've been going through over the past year, basically to reprocess one of our archival oral history collections, the Dean Rusk Oral History Collection. Just to kind of give you an overview of what I'm going to talk about, I'll give you some background on the collection, and then I'll talk about some of the technologies we've been using and also some of the challenges we faced sort of working back through this collection. I'll talk about the initial goals for the projects, some of the challenges with establishing control over the collection, and then I'll briefly talk about our digitization process, and then I'll talk about the new platform we've been using, OHMS, the Oral History Metadata Synchronizer, to make this collection available in a new way for us. The Dean Rusk collection is one of our archival oral history collections. And I'm using the word archival to sort of distinguish it between, we have collections that were created by a researcher and then donated to the library, but then we also have an active oral history program at our library where we travel and go and collect oral histories ourselves. So this is one of the ones that was sort of given to us. Many of you are probably familiar with Dean Rusk, but for those who aren't, he was a Georgian who served as Secretary of State under Kennedy and Johnson. So he was basically through all of the 60s and was involved in things like the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Vietnam War. The oral history collection that we have is the product of interviews that his son, Richard, did with Dean Rusk in the mid-1980s. And the interviews were done in preparation for a book that they co-wrote together called As I Saw It, which was published in 91. We have about 175 audio cassettes from this project, so he really took a lot of time recording these interviews, and they're not just with a lot of them are with Richard and Dean, but then he also went and interviewed a lot of Dean Rusk's colleagues who he worked with while he was Secretary of State. So it's a really rich collection, and Dean Rusk had famously said that he would never write his memoirs, and he was kind of known for being sort of inscrutable and was described as a silent Buddha figure. So having these recordings with his son is a really unique glimpse into this kind of enigmatic figure in our nation's history. So it's a really cool collection. And it's been really popular at the Russell Library. So when I started, I've been at the Russell not quite 2 years now. So when I started in 2012, the only way that you could access these interviews was via a printed transcript. And so if you weren't able to visit our library in Athens, we would send you a physical copy of the transcript via interlibrary loan. All we had were these printed transcripts. We had done preservation transfers. They were originally recorded on audio cassettes, but we had done preservation transfers to open reel magnetic tape in the 90s. But there were basically no digital components to the collection whatsoever. So when we started the project, there are a few main goals. Digitizing the transcripts so we could get out of the ILL business, digitizing the original audio cassettes. These are really interesting interviews, and having that audio would be a great dimension to be able to hear the interactions and that kind of thing, and making that available for really the first time. And then third, we wanted to make this our newly digitized audio and transcripts available via OHMS. I'm going to get more in depth on OHMS later, but just to kind of give you a little bit of background on what OHMS is, it's an open source platform that was developed at the University of Kentucky at the Louis B. Nunn Center for Oral History under the direction of Doug Boyd. And it's a platform that allows you to present your collections, present your digitized audio or video alongside a time-synced transcript and also an index for the interview, which is sort of like chapter headings for the interview. But you know, in order to get from our papers and boxes of audio cassettes to enhanced access for everyone via the internet, we had a lot of steps to get through. So the first stage, and really, I feel like this has been the biggest challenge throughout the history of this project, is establishing control of the collection. And I say establishing control to really mean like knowing what we have in the collection so that we can know what decisions and make the best decisions for working with the collection. So the first step in this was sort of doing a survey to figure out what we had. And there were three, you know, what I thought were pretty basic questions we wanted to answer. What transcripts do we have? What audio do we have? And what releases do we have? And in the beginning, I thought answering this was going to go pretty quickly. This was a collection that we'd had for a number of years. We had a finding aid for the collection listing all the interviews. We had various staff members who worked on the collection a little bit, so we had, you know, all these documents in our shared drive that I was like, we're sure we're going to be a treasure trove. But the deeper I got into it, the more these questions spawned other questions, like a multi-headed monster. And I could talk about this collection for hours, but I just wanted to kind of go over a few of the main challenges and sort of the time sucks that I encountered, so that those of you who may be thinking about a similar project, things you might want to look out for. So to start with the transcripts, we were lucky to have these transcripts. Most of the interviews were transcribed. But transcription standards have changed a lot in the past 20-ish years since these were transcribed. And I realized pretty quickly that the transcripts that we had were pretty different from what we would produce if we were going to transcribe these in-house today. There was a lot of stuff that just wasn't in the transcripts. Anything that wasn't 100% on topic was left out of the transcript. Whenever they would stop and start the tape player, that was never indicated in the transcript. Sometimes there were speakers who only spoke a little bit, but there was no indication that they were involved. The phrasing was sometimes minorly edited so that when you read the transcript, it would be more grammatically correct. All things that were pretty common and are still kind of common, but not necessarily what we would consider like an ideal transcript. And at our institution, we're not super hung up on having perfect, triple audited, excellent transcripts. But we did want to know the degree to which these had been edited so that we would know what we're working with here. For the audio, I mean, anyone who's working with an audiovisual collection, there's always like the basic problem that until you like put your tape in a deck and press play, you have no idea what is actually on that tape. So for example, we stuck in sort of towards the end of the oral histories. We had a little gem. This was a song that was recorded in 1961 that I'll just play a little snippet of, if I can. Love this song, but not exactly an oral history. So it's always an adventure with audiovisual material. And additionally, we had no real sense of how long the recordings were, because you know, some cassettes would end up having about 2 hours of recorded material, others more like 15 minutes. And it just makes it hard to plan how much storage space you're gonna need, how much time it's gonna take to digitize them, all of the kind of stuff you have to deal with AV materials. As I said, the releases, we were lucky that the main interviewers, Richard Rusk and then Thomas Schoenbaum, who was a professor at the University of Georgia, they did get release forms from the vast majority of the participants. but it was a little bit of a challenge because all of the release forms were in one folder. We have over 150 interviews. Some interviewers were on multiple tapes, and just sort of like making a giant spreadsheet and comparing it to make sure we had release forms, because ultimately we wanted to put these online and wanted to make sure we had permission to do that, was took a little bit of time. Another challenge that we kind of ran into was, you know, what I'll call like questionable metadata that had been handed down with the collection. For example, and this kind of goes back to the release forms, about 10 to 15 of the interviews were marked closed in our finding aid. And when I hear the word closed, you know, I assume that an interviewee has requested that the interview be restricted, or that there's a preservation concern, or something along those lines that would prevent you from accessing it. But as I got further into this, I realized that some of these were marked closed just because we didn't have a transcript for the interview. Which kind of makes sense when transcripts were the only way people could get to the collection. If there was no to the interview, if there was no transcript, then it was essentially closed. But since we're digitizing all of these and digitizing the audio, it no longer needed to be closed. But you know, you want to always like make sure there wasn't like a real reason for things to be closed. So it's a lot of wading through documentation and trying to figure out what was going on, there. And you know, there was a lot of incomplete metadata. We only had exact dates for about a third of the interviews. It made it really hard to piece together which interviews. Some interview sessions clearly stretched over multiple tapes, but trying to figure out which tapes went together, they weren't listed in chronological order. The naming convention for this collection is like my favorite quirk. They started with Rusk A, Rusk B, Rusk C. But there are over 170 tapes, so we run out of the alphabet pretty quickly. So we just move on to the doubles, then the triples. So we make it all the way to Rusk 7T. And it's just a really like bulky naming system and confusing to try and work with, and especially when you're working with the eyes and you're like, how many eyes is that that I'm looking at? So I would have loved to go back and just rename everything, but the collection's been out there for 20 years, so that's not really archivally appropriate, so we're stuck with it. I'm actually not going to get too much into the details of our digitization process, except to say that even though this was sort of the stated goal of the project, the actual digitization, you know, scanning the pages and digitizing the cassettes, went really smoothly. It was all of the stuff that you have to do to make that digitization worthwhile that was really the time, where a lot of the time and energy came in. I'm at a university, so we have a whole like army of student slave labor kind of. So I used a lot of students and was lucky to find some really talented students to help with the digitization process. But yeah, like I said, it's all of the collecting the metadata and double checking your lists and keeping track of the digital files and how they relate to the analog media. That's where all of the energy really went. So I mentioned earlier that sort of our end goal was to have this collection digitized so that we could present it through OHMS, the Oral History Metadata Synchronizer. I can't do a live demonstration of OHMS here, but basically it allows you to have your audio or video. In our case, we had audio for this collection, and what you're seeing here is sort of an index for the collection, which you create, and it sort of functions as chapter headings so that someone can kind of scroll down and see what are the main topics in here. And each of those index headings expands to show a synopsis of that segment and then keywords associated with that part of the interview, so that you can also search and do a keyword search within the interview and jump to different places. If you have a transcript for your interview, you can sync that to your media, so that you can also jump around that way with at different times throughout throughout the transcript. But I really think the indexing is the exciting part of OHMS, because you know, as Amy mentioned, and as anybody who's ever done transcription knows, it can be a super resource intensive process. And being able to index an interview kind of gives you the same similar results from coming up with a transcript, but it takes a lot less time and sometimes can even be more efficient, because you can use keywords, you know, sort of like one of the classic examples is if somebody's talking about segregation, they may never use the word segregation. They may just talk about not being able to use the same facilities, but you can pop in the keyword segregation in your index and jump right to that part of the interview. So that's really, really nice. I know that nobody can see any of the words on this flowchart, but the main point I want to make about the sort of technical setup of OHMS is that it's not a repository. It doesn't store your media. You have to have the ability to host your audio and video somewhere else. OHMS pulls in that media. You log into an application where you create the index and sync your transcript, and then the end result is an XML file that you spit out and host on your server. And so you also install the OHMS viewer on your server, but it's, according to our IT guys at least, like pretty easy to install. The whole idea behind OHMS is to make this a tool that repositories of different resources can use. And so that's kind of how OHMS works. And for us, it was relatively easy to get buy-in from our IT department and also our administration to kind of start playing around with OHMS. And XML files take up very little space. So we already had the ability to host our audio through a University System of Georgia podcasting server. So we weren't really asking for a whole lot of server space here. But you know, after getting OHMS set up, then you have to start actually putting your interviews and putting your collections into OHMS. Basically, there are four interconnected pieces. You have to have your basic metadata about your interview dates and the interviewee names and that kind of thing, the collection name. You need your digital media, and then there's the index and the digital transcript if you have one. We didn't have any trouble getting our audio to work with OHMS, but it did take a little bit of effort to get the transcripts to work. The transcripts that we had, the printed transcripts I talked about earlier, were probably at least second-generation photocopies. These were transcribed in some sort of word processing software, but those digital files were no longer part of the collection and were lost to time. So we had to, you know, scan them and then do OCR, optical character recognition, to extract the text from the scans. So there were a lot of hours spent wrestling with the OCR functions. We ended up purchasing a program called Abbey Fine Reader, which was only about $75. Highly recommend it, which helped a lot with getting the OCRing done. And then just doing text cleanup macros, like writing and rewriting macros in Microsoft Word. All of that like extra like formatting that Microsoft Word does is like really fun to try and get rid of. And we weren't aiming for perfection, but to put the transcripts in OHMS, you really need to have pretty plain, unformatted or very minimally formatted text to work with. So we just had to get rid of a lot of little stuff like that. For the indexing, my colleague Christian Lopez and I, we did some of the initial indexes ourselves to get a feel for it. And then we ended up hiring an undergraduate to help with the indexing. The thing I'll say about indexing is it kind of, you know, it requires you to listen to these oral histories, which are at times sort of rambling conversations where people are jumping from topic to topic, and you have to take all of this and then distill it into like a discrete heading for what this section of the interview is going to be about. So I don't know if you remember Bloom's taxonomy, that little educational theory, but it's definitely near like the top of the pyramid. It takes not just any undergraduate off the streets is going to like be able to handle the indexing. So we feel really lucky to have found a student who has really taken to it well. And the best part is she still is not finished with her degree, so we can like squeeze some more out of her over the next year. So I've spent a lot of time talking about the challenges involved with the project, but I did want to just mention a few of the positive returns we've already had since sort of taking this over. You know, besides just generally increasing access to this collection, which we're really excited about, and making the audio available for the first time, we've also had some concrete material gains. I wrote an article about the project in our library's newsletter, and then we got a check from a donor who's like, "This is awesome. Just give me a copy of the transcripts. Here's some money." So that's always nice. We were also, you know, Georgia Public Broadcasting was doing a documentary on Dean Rusk, and we were able to help them with their research. They were able to do, you know, keyword searching within the indexes to try and find clips they could use, and also do all of this from their offices in Atlanta instead of having to send someone up to Athens. So that was really nice. And then also being involved with OMES has allowed Christian and I to sort of get involved with other institutions who have similar goals and collections and get involved in that community. As for the next stages, we have only done about, we've only fully completed indexes and syncing transcripts for about 12 to 15 of the interviews so far. So we still have a lot to go with that. And for us, this is kind of just going to be an as we have people to work on it process. We're not really operating under any specific time deadlines. We also want to do a more comprehensive inventory of all the audio that's with this collection, because we have the Dean Rusk oral history collection, but then we also have the Dean Rusk papers that have audiovisual components that are just not oral histories, but some of those have transcripts. And it's called the Oral History Metadata Synchronizer, but that's just because that's who developed it. You could really use it with any sort of time-based media that you wanted to sync a transcript to or make an index for. And as for the rights and privacy issues, you know, I mentioned earlier that we have a lot of releases, but there's still some we're missing, so we're going to maybe start looking into seeing if we can get in touch with the people who we don't have the releases from or their heirs if they're no longer living, and then also just kind of looking at what our options might be for making those available, since you know, having a closed interview in your collection is, it's not a good feeling. You want to like put as much out there as you can, of course, while respecting the rights and privacy issues of the people who are involved with the collection. Overall, it's been a real adventure in using student labor and, you know, wrangling them into doing what you want. And as I said, the things that you think are going to be easy are always the things that start spouting new heads that you have to deal with. So thank you.
We have time for questions. Do you have any questions? Questions for Callie?
Yes.
I was just kind of curious with the digital text transcripts. Do you do any sort of like markup on them, or does that kind of come out in the XML document that gets spit out through OMES, or is that part of the workflow at all?
No, we really just do like the simple plain text, and it's and the way it works with syncing it in the XML document, it's sort of a process where it knows what character of what line goes with what time code of the audio, and so it inserts these little brackets within the transcript that syncs it up. Mm-hmm. And it's meant to be it's sort of a funny looking way when you look at the XML document. The way the transcript synced is sort of strange looking. But Doug Boyd, who was, you know, in charge of this project developing OMES, was his thought behind it was he wanted it to be something that if OMES isn't here in 10 or 15 years, the work you did syncing the transcript wouldn't just be lost, that someone with basic computer programming experience would be able to see how that syncing was working and recreate something that could use it. Sorry.
Are you exclusively working on this Dean Rusk project, or are you specifically hired for this? And what happens if the other famous Georgians going to bring you all kinds of collections? Will you ever get through with them?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it feels like I'm exclusively working with Dean Rusk, but no, I'm seeing other people too. But yeah, we're just starting with Dean Rusk because it's one of our most popular collections and one that's really rich. But we've also started putting some of our other collections in OMES that we didn't have. I think our next priority will be collections that we don't have transcripts for, because that is kind of like the most bang for our buck, being able to create the index access points to those interviews. Thanks.